Okay, well, our guest tonight is Virgil Dean of the Kansas State Historical Society. I thought it'd be an interesting twist to, instead of just having rank-and-file Kansans, which is what we've done pretty much here, to have a professional historian come in and provide a perspective that is both personal and, I think, informed by the profession itself. So I've known Virgil for a number of years now, and he's does terrific work. He's, among other things, edits Kansas History Magazine, our standard state historical journal, and says despite the state budget, he's surviving so far over the State Historical Society. So before I actually start asking questions and things, I do want to include our standard permission, as it were, which we're doing orally, which is, you've seen the website, we want to post this on there as one of the many stories, and want to be sure you understand that that's what's going to happen, that it's going to be publicly available.
Okay.
So we're doing this quite informally. It's pretty much just letting people tell stories. So I guess, I don't know where you started out. I know where you're a church member now, but maybe can you start with childhood and your religious upbringing? Was that in Kansas for openers?
Yeah, I grew up, I was born in Franklin, Kansas, and grew up in Ottawa, actually, and grew up in a little community called Peoria. It's still called that, but there's not much there now. There wasn't too much there then, but there was a rural school where I attended for 7 years, and a grocery store when I was first remembering things, and a church. And the church that was left, at one time the community had two churches, which is probably not unusual for small towns, even though there was never very much in there. But then they were almost back to back. They sat right almost on the same property, adjoining properties at least. And the church that I attended and where my parents and grandparents were fairly active was an Evangelical United Brethren, or EUB, church. And it was a struggling rural church for a long time. We generally shared ministers. We did have, there was a parsonage across the street, but or across the road, but it was not in use most of the time. I can vaguely remember we still had a full-time minister and family that lived there, but it that ceased to be fairly soon. And so we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s, and for the time I remember most, we shared a pastor with the congregation at Warden, which you might be familiar with, down on go down to Baldwin Junction, which is quite changed right now because of the road construction. And instead of going east to Baldwin, go west a little ways. And Warden is a relatively wide spot in the road that still has a church. They've fairly recently, but within the last few years, I think either redid or they remodeled the church and expanded. I think the old structure is still there, but I'm not positive. But anyway, we shared a minister with them for a number of years, and that was as much a community church because of that. Lay people were really very active in keeping the thing going with Bible school and Sunday school, and so you have that kind of situation. And then in the mid to late 80s, I think it's about 66 or 67, 68, somewhere in there, the EUB Church and Methodist United became United Methodist. And at that point, our congregation was small. I was, would have been in high school, I think, or just getting ready to go off to college. So I just spotty memories of all that went on, but the community members who were there decided they didn't want to go the route of uniting with the Methodists, and were given the option to take over the property and tried to go with a kind of an independent community church for a while, which struggled for a few years until it finally closed sometime in the 70s.
Now, it was an EUB church.
Yeah, it was an EUB church.
Now, the church at Warden was a different denomination, I think.
Well, I think it was EUB then.
Was it?
And now it's United, and it became United Methodist.
I thought it's United Church of Christ now.
It may be. Well, I think they're actually, isn't there another church that's United Church of Christ that's there?
There are two churches in Warden. Oh, okay, then that's
the one on the south side of the road. I think is still United Methodist.
Okay, okay, yeah, I'm thinking of the one on the north,
yeah.
Okay.
That's right. And so, okay. Warden isn't very big. It's bigger than Peoria.
Are there two churches in Warden?
Two churches, I know we rented a house out in the Willow Springs area, which is where that is, in southern Douglas County, and knew some people that went to that other church at Warden. And then, of course, you have the German Baptist Church that's out there, too, so mm-hmm. They're growing on a lot of the same rural area.
Right.
And probably struggling. But then, if I go on, I've had, of course, like many college students and at different stages of life, various degrees of involvement. I think I really became committed to Christian faith when I was fairly young in that church, but then at different times, of course, varying degrees of non-involvement or involvement in the church. When I was in college, I didn't do anything but go home. When I went home, attended then. And then in younger adult years, was involved with a couple different Baptist churches in towns. I was in Garden City and then Emporia, where I both towns where I taught for a while. And then it was when I moved to Lawrence. My wife is really the reason why I became connected with the Lutheran Church here. We were married 26 years ago, but I think I've been active in membership for about 20 years. But her background is Lutheran and Missouri Synod in particular, and so that's kind of where I came into the church here in Lawrence. And since that time, I've been the last 15 to 20 years been real active in the church, the number of leadership positions and various things. But that brings us up to date, I guess, in
okay.
Moderate amount of detail.
Okay. Now, Emmanuel Lutheran is Missouri Synod. Mm-hmm. Which is the most conservative of the major Lutheran branches, basically. Mm-hmm. Most people characterize it that way.
Of the two big ones, yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. They tell me, and I don't know too much about the other synods, but the ELCA, of course, now is the largest by quite a ways, mm-hmm. and then the Missouri Synod, and certainly that's true there. And then you get with Wisconsin and mm-hmm. so on down the line.
Yeah. One thing about, was curious about, is these Lutheran churches used to be pretty ethnic in orientation. When people came into the country, we had Norwegian Lutherans mm-hmm. and Danish Lutherans and Swedish Lutherans and all, and they really, a lot of them were identified by a national name. And gradually, that's disappeared largely, mm-hmm. but Missouri Synod was mainly German.
Right.
And I just wonder, are there any real traces of German culture left in it, or is that just faded over time?
Yeah. I think there are among probably older members, for certainly that's the case, that it would still be there. Older, either my age and older, I think, would be the case. So that we have, for example, the pastor we have now, Randy Weinkauf, is originally from Minnesota, and he has come from a very strong German Lutheran mm-hmm. background. There are several members of the church that have either one or the other of the spouses or both that are, like I say, my age or probably in most cases older, a little bit older, who have that tradition. And I think there's still quite a few that would trace it back several generations. Maybe most. I don't know. I mean, my wife is, like I said, my wife's involvement or membership, lifelong membership and affiliation with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is how I got into it. I have no ethnic ties whatsoever with that church and with the denomination. And even though I have a little German in my background, it's pretty faint. And all my ethnic influences are pretty watered down and go back many generations. My wife's family has both German and Swedish Lutheran backgrounds. So her dad was Swedish, her mom was German, and her grandfather, I think he was born in America, but it was, you know, his parents, he was pretty young, I think, his parents hadn't been in the country very long. So, like, they're like late 19th century immigrants. And so it's a fairly close thing. And I think still, I think if you look at the Emmanuel Lutheran, probably a large majority of the members could trace, like I say, one side of the family or the other to some heritage that would be the reason why they're pulled into that tradition.
Well, another thing about background, and I don't know how well-read you are on this, because I think it's somewhat before your time in the church, but the Missouri Synod went through a very serious liberal-conservative split, and that was what, 60s, 70s?
Mm-hmm. 70s, I think.
70s.
Yeah.
Can you say something about that?
Well, not too much. I don't know very much about it, but I know in the case of our congregation, which I wasn't a part of at that time, but that's what led to the formation of Redeemer Lutheran, as I understand it. So there was, even within the Missouri, and it remained Missouri Synod, but even within the Missouri Synod, there were splits that happened over communion and fellowship and that kind of thing with other denominations, or other Lutheran denominations. And so a number of people who had been in Emmanuel Lutheran Church left, and that's when, as I understand it, I'm not mistaken on that, when the Redeemer Lutheran was formed, started. And so you have two Missouri Synod Lutheran churches in town, partly as a result of that. So with Emmanuel, to a certain extent, taking the more liberal route.
That's what I would have guessed.
It wouldn't be perceptibly that much to most people, but I think looking at it doctrinally, there was a liberal conservative split within the, being careful how you use those terms, within the Missouri Synod, and that's what happened there. And so those congregations maintain their relationship and ties with the Kansas District and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in that way, but still, and it kind of, I guess, emphasizes the independence of the local congregation, too, because there is considerable independence among protection of that independence among most congregations. Emmanuel Lutheran has always had a strong connection with the university, or had a strong sense of mission with regard to providing services providing fellowship and services with the university students. And so sometime not too long before that, when the Lutheran Campus Center was built, which is where we're at now, that facility was started separately, and then Emmanuel merged with that in the late Well, the merger came in the 1980s.
Well, it used to be called University Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm. Lutheran Church, and it was a Missouri Synod, but they did have some more, I think, more fellowship with others too. Oh. But Emmanuel had some fairly close ties with that, but it was totally separate. Yeah, until the late 80s, when the district decided that it was in need of some more support and that a merger was probably a good idea for the two. So Emmanuel Lutheran had been downtown down at 17th in Vermont prior to that, and moved there in the 1950s, and then in the 1980s moved, and they united with the University Church. Remodeled the church and moved into that facility. And so now Emmanuel Lutheran Church and University Student Center is the official name.
Just to look at some of these liberal conservative issues, one I know divisive issue among Lutherans has been open or closed communion. Mm-hmm. Has that played out as a controversy locally?
Well, I think it's something that's still discussed. In other words, how open are you with regard to who is allowed to take communion? Mm-hmm. At Emmanuel, as long as I've been there, we call it closed communion or closed communion, and it still is to a certain extent, but it's relatively open under certain guidelines. So if you there's no requirement that you have to go to a minister or an elder or something and talk to them about your particular faith belief, or that you have to necessarily show that you are Lutheran before you can commune. There is a statement of faith that would ask that people that agree with that are welcome to come to the altar for communion. But there is still a discussion within the synod and within the district and among churches about how strictly those kinds of things should be monitored and followed, and I think it is still an issue. So and that varies considerably from congregation to congregation.
Just to pick another issue that has been an issue in all kinds of denominations, what does the Missouri Synod and Emmanuel particularly do about women in the clergy?
The Missouri Synod Lutheran still does not allow women in pastoral positions. And most Missouri Synod Lutheran churches have not traditionally, they have extended the pastoral role to include the elders. But that is starting, has started to change within congregations to a certain extent. But the pastoral office is still confined to men, even though, at least in Emmanuel, there are a number of people who think that it's time for that policy or that particular practice to leave. How soon that will actually happen. It's interesting when you look at the doctrinal statements or the explanations of certain things within the literature that comes from Synod or from the district office, a lot of things are very vague, and that's left up to congregations. Some Missouri Synod Lutheran congregations have not, and probably won't for a long time, have women presidents of the congregation. We have one who will be head of women president. We have one that's vice president now. So, and that's changing considerably over time.
So then you have
We actually don't have female elders at this time. The current minister that we have, I think, is inclined to, within certain parameters, move in that direction. He said, and we're just implementing a system of having assistant elders people who would do pretty much the same thing, but be in a little different official capacity, and those are open to both.
So an elder isn't exactly an officer then of the church. What is the elder? What do they do? And how many are there? And how are they chosen?
The guidelines are kind of like, I think it's 100 members per elder, you know, the church is supposed to follow. So we have 6 elders, I think, at this time in the church. They're basically there to administer to spiritual needs of members and also provide support for the pastor. Traditionally have helped with the serving of communion and other kinds of baptisms and so forth to a certain extent, but they're they don't fill the role of a minister, but they are involved in those kinds of functions and responsibilities. So it's a spiritual support kind of office, and working closely with the pastor. I think traditionally it's only been male elders who have helped, like, serve communion. We've had women helping in that capacity for quite a long time at Emmanuel. Some people think that's good, some don't. So you still have differences of opinion within the congregation.
And are they self-selected, or?
Pardon me?
How are the elders selected?
Yeah, they're elected. So it's kind of like an office. We have both church officers and we have elders. So we have a board of elders that fill that capacity, and then we have a president, a vice president, and have council officers, and those offices, for as long as I've been in the church, have been open to anyone, any voting member of the congregation. But elders are where there are still restrictions.
Well, can you characterize what life in the church is like? I mean, you have Sunday services, I presume, but what else? Or even what are the services like?
Well, we have, for quite a number of years, we've had, like I mentioned, we have in the late 80s, 1987 or 8, is when the university, Emmanuel Lutheran and the University Student Center, united and moved into the building on the 15th and or Bob Billings in Iowa, and not too long after that, the decision was made to try to move to both a traditional liturgical service, which is pretty common in Lutheran churches, to have also an option of a more contemporary type of service. So different music and a little bit more relaxed atmosphere. That's been something we've had a music director who's been able to deal with that and provide a lot of leadership in that way. And it's not the kind of contemporary service that you might find in a lot of other churches, but still a very different kind of, fairly different kind of service. Because of financial issues, we've eliminated our full-time music director position and been kind of moving in back towards more traditional services simply for economic reasons of late. But in addition to the Sunday services, where we do have a traditional service and a more contemporary, or we have until recently had a more contemporary, we also have Bible classes a pretty active congregation in providing a lot of other kinds of opportunities for different kinds of service and fellowship throughout the week, basically as much involvement as a person wants. We've recently gotten into the Family Promise ministry. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
What is that?
That or not. The, are you are?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
The, and you probably didn't know more than I do, although my wife and I are a host family. And so what it means, we had to go through some training. Assistant pastor, I think, at Presbyterian, the Congregational Church, Plymouth Congregational, is kind of in charge of this, as I understand it. And it's an attempt to get a number of churches involved with providing housing for homeless families. Okay. So they have anywhere from, I think, half a dozen to 14, 20 people that will go from, and we do this once a quarter, and provide a place for these people to stay, these guests to stay overnight for, and providing meals during a week-long period.
And I believe also job support, right? And help.
I think the program does that, yeah. I think the individual churches that host them, we take care of what needs to happen so they have a place to stay, and then they leave during the day and go to the center downtown, go out to their jobs or whatever is going on. So we've just been involved for, I guess it's just getting started this year, and so we've been involved a couple different cycles of providing. The first time it was, I think there were about 15 individuals, adults and children, who come and stay. And this last time was only about a half a dozen, couple weeks ago. So it's an interesting social ministry. Our church is also involved with the LINK program, the community meals program, and so a number of things like that.
So the family's actually housed in the church building?
They come in, and that's where they stay. They come there, I think, about 5 or 5:30 in the evening, and they leave real early in the morning. And we provide them with supper, place to sleep, and they leave their stuff there, whatever they have, they can stay during the week, and then they go somewhere else for a week and for the next week. And so I don't know, some of the other churches may be handling it differently, but when I went through, my wife and I went through the training session, that was the way it was explained, and so you do it once a quarter, so that,
For a week,
every quarter, each church is committed at least that much. And you have people that stay overnight with them and provide some kind of security and oversight.
And is it more than one family that comes at the time?
Yeah, it's been real interesting to see. I mean, it's like you would, there are couples occasionally. What I've seen, I'm just had the experience twice, but we had, I think... we had at least, but most of the time it's single parents, and it can be fathers with children as well as mothers with children. I mean, we've had both situations. Mm-hmm. So it's all kinds of configurations of families is my observation. It's an interesting program. I hopefully it's making a difference with some people. What's your experience?
I followed it really closely, and I was going to ask, I know when they first came up with the idea, there was a lot of, there were some people who didn't want homeless people staying in their church or in their neighborhoods. There were some zoning issues. And I believe
just like there are with the shelter. Yeah.
Sure, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it got a little bit nasty, at least when I heard through the rumor mills. And I'm just curious, I'm a parishioner at St. John's, and they participate in the Family Promise. Mm-hmm. And I've not gone through the training, but I have some friends who do it. They've done it mm-hmm. every time they can. I was curious if at your church, if there was any hesitation about that.
I didn't hear a lot of that within the from members, that people that were opposed to it. I don't know, but I can imagine why there would be, and I'm sure there's concern about, keeping upkeep on the building, and of course, in any church We have like 500 members at Emmanuel, but only probably 200 that are about half of that membership that's very active. And then, I mean, in terms of just attendance, and then you have a smaller percentage of those who really do the legwork. And so you end up having a lot of the responsibility for doing those things on the same people that are involved in a lot of other things. And I'm sure there are some that feel a little put upon, but I really haven't heard anybody voice from the very beginning any strong objections to it. I'm not sure whether there was any opposition when we first decided to go into it or not. I'm not currently on the church council, so I may have missed some of that. But my wife is, so I would have heard about it from her. So, from the very beginning, as far as I know, there hasn't been too much. Yeah. And I don't know if they're having, I haven't had any contact with anybody on the outside, and I haven't really talked this over with the one or two people who are our main coordinators of the program, but I haven't heard anybody express any real concern.
I haven't heard much about it lately, it's become established, and mm-hmm. we worked out all of those things.
And I'm not sure, what it means that we had 14 people the first, 14 or 15 the first time we hosted, and only 6 or 7 the last time. I mean, is that good, or does that mean the program's not working? Or, we had a couple of people, at least a couple, father and a son, I think, who were back, who were still involved with it. Had not changed their situation yet. So.
No, there are a lot more kids staying at the shelter proper now than
really
there used to be. Mm-hmm. Definitely the numbers are increasing.
Yeah. And I think they've always had, and it's that way I understood it, in this Family Promise program, some fairly strict guidelines of who they would take into that. I mean, it's got to be families, and it's got to be, they've got to have, they're not going to just take in anybody, so they're trying to make sure that you kind of ward off some of the problems that people would have been concerned about, I think, in terms of care of the facility and that kind of thing. So. But yeah, we set them up in the Sunday school rooms, and uh-huh. so they had some relative privacy anyway mm-hmm. at that time. And fortunately, what I think helped us. Maybe made it possible for us to be involved because we recently finished an addition to the church. We dedicated it about a year ago, so we have a large activity center and some additional a new kitchen and some additional space, which is still in need of totally being finished, but the activity center and the kitchen and some of the critical areas are, and that gave us some nice space to use that because we also have a childhood center that we've been operating for as a mission outreach for the church since the early 90s, I think, for so almost 20 years.
Is that like a daycare center?
Daycare center, childhood center. So they have toddlers to preschool both. Mm-hmm. And they're there all the time, so they have that. This is our addition was somewhat motivated by that too, because trying to share space with the childhood center and convert, be able to use that effectively on Sundays for classrooms or whatever was always a real problem. So now we have a more or less dedicated space to the childhood center, and have moved the other activities into our new wing.
What do you have for apart from these service projects, which sound fairly extensive, mm-hmm. really, what do you have for just pure social activities? Potluck dinners?
Yeah, you have your traditional potluck dinner that we have from time to time. We usually have those on a fairly regular basis. That we have started doing that more again now since we have better space. And so... whatever excuse you might have for something like that. I think we're scheduled to have one, at least one every quarter now, or maybe it's, I forget what it is exactly, but we have new member opportunities to do that. We also, well, there are things like the Women's Missionary League, LWML, that has various kinds of activities. This last week they had a bazaar and this kind of thing. We work the KU basketball games for selling T-shirts and stuff for money raiser. So
you go over to the field house, you enter in games and sell shirts.
And
so what are you doing here tonight?
Yeah, well, I could have easily been working over there, although I do that too occasionally, but I try not to do too many. I had to get out of that one tonight. So no, it's but there, yeah, frequent things, like I say, opportunities to be involved all the time.
Is it pretty, people get along pretty well? Do you have any factions and hostilities and things like that?
We've had ups and downs with different issues. I think, generally speaking, most of the time people get along pretty well, but there are things that cause division. We had some serious division within the church when we were going through our move towards doing a building project, and there was, without getting into the gory details, we did lose some members then who were not happy with the way things went, primarily because they believed it was time for Emmanuel to do its expansion, I think, elsewhere rather than where we were located, and had some different ideas about that.
You mean start a new Lutheran church?
Yeah, either start a new church in town or build a new facility, like on the plan initially that was underway by some was to move out west and get rid of the location that we were in.
What would you do with that building if you moved?
I know.
What do you do with a church building?
What do you do with it? I don't know. You know, the problem is that there wouldn't have been the money there that we would have had to try to sell it. And, you know, you don't know what kind of market there would be for something like that. And I think most people believed that that's, you know, the location where we need to be. I mean, it's had the campus relationship for a long time, and that's been an important part of the ministry. We do have still a campus minister, campus pastor, and have had since the two churches came together. So
someone who's full-time?
Right.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. That's kind of being phased down because of financial issues and numbers. But until recently, we still have, but it probably won't be the situation for too much longer because of some issues that came up with financial issues that have come up with that and district support for that and a new idea for how they would kind of approach campus ministry. But we have had two pastors, one primarily focused on student activities with also some preaching and other kinds of congregational duties, but mainly preaching and serving the student population as long as I guess that continued to be the case after the two churches came together.
Since the church came apart as two, or maybe I'm just presuming from what I know of churches, but and you may not know this because you clearly are among members that stay, but is there a church on the west side that those people sort of
part
of two?
No, some of those people who left, and this was three or four years ago now, that we had, when you look at it, issues that arose that really shouldn't have been the kind of issues that would divide a church, but any kind of issue can, as you probably know if you have been involved at all. It doesn't take much. They tell me, since I'm relatively new, I've only been around for 20 years, they tell me Lutheran, they talk about how bad Lutherans are about doing that. Well, I was I've always had that experience. I mean, we had our little church, we had the little community church in my community, that there were people that had gone there and they got upset about something or other and were going other places. So even in a community that was relatively small, you didn't have everybody, you know, fellowshipping or worshiping in the same place. And some of those were some variety of reasons, but others were just because people had gone here at one point and they, for some reason or other, left. But, the issues that had to do with this most recent situation were not issues that had to do with doctrine or you know, what was being preached or the ministry. It was issues that arose that got too personal, you know, and people didn't act as they should have acted as Christians. And so they some just left. And I think there was an idea, well, there was an idea for a while of starting another church with this core group of people who were dissatisfied with the way things were going at Emmanuel. But eventually they didn't get the support that they needed, and some went to the other Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. Others, there were a few went elsewhere to other churches.
Well, that happens in all churches, I think.
Yeah, it's the human element. Yeah. Any organization has those issues that will divide people. And so we shouldn't be surprised, I think, that churches face the same problems.
And I think the rule of thumb is that the level of emotion and antagonism about it all is inversely related to the significance of the issue itself.
That's what I frequently think too. You know, if you the less you have at stake, really, the more likely you are to get emotional about it.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me, again as an outsider, that you're sort of admitting that Lutherans have that reputation. I only know that from perhaps our national Lutheran, Garrison Keillor, telling that joke about the Lutheran on the desert island. He's literally alone, and they say, "What's that building?" And he says, "Oh, that's where I go to church." He goes, "What's that building?" "That's where I used to go to church."
I haven't heard that one, although I'm a faithful, faithful listener of Garrison Keillor. I haven't heard that one. That's a given. Well, that's what I've, you know, from my beginning involvement with Lutherans, the Lutheran Church here, I've always heard that, and then I think either just before or just after, started listening to Prairie Home Companion. And you certainly do get that there.
I suppose Luther was the originary dissenter, so...
Yeah, but as Tim said, you know, I think there are lots of churches, if not most, that have that kind of, they could point to that same thing happening. I know Baptist churches are certainly notorious for splitting off. Whether it's a mainline Baptist or an independent Baptist, I mean, you know.
But it seems to be coming from the congregation, because in my experience, I don't know, the Jews follow the leader. I mean, it's about the ego of the pastor. They always split when he wants his own congregation. How has that happened with your pastors? I mean, how are they selected? And do they want to start their own flock?
I haven't experienced that in our church. This was just a group of individuals who left. We did have about the time or shortly after this took place, and almost during the time, we had a pastor retire, and then we had went through a call process, and that's how we get some support that when the minister leaves for whatever reason, the congregation then goes through a process of issuing a call to another minister, and the district office, which is in Topeka for the Kansas District of Missouri Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, provides names. The congregation can suggest names. There's kind of a process of saying, okay, would these be appropriate to consider? We had a call committee, and it was a fairly long process. It could go quick, it could go long. It depends on how soon somebody accepts the call that you issue. that's how it's done, and it's only, you know, you're going to be calling another Missouri Synod pastor from somewhere else. So I don't think you have, I don't know. My experience has not been where a minister would lead the split, but I have had that experience, or known of that experience, in Baptist churches, for example, particularly independent Baptist churches, where that would happen.
How many at a time do you have more than one pastor?
We've had, and still have, again, like I said, it probably won't be for very much longer, a campus minister and then a parish pastor. And we've had that situation ever since the Emmanuel Lutheran United merged with University Student, or the Lutheran. You said the right name. All I can think of is University Student Center, but that's what it became when it merged.
It was University Lutheran Church.
Yeah, University Lutheran Church, yeah.
For a while,
that's right. And we usually have, you know, we've had the two full-time pastors for all that length of time, so almost 20 years.
Over 20 years. What other staff do you have?
We just have a full-time secretary now. We did have, like I said, until recently, we had a half-time music director. We have, and that position was eliminated. Now we're just providing music. But for a while we did voluntary, and now we're paying by service for an organist and whatever anything else that we decide we need. But so far it's just been that. This has just been within the last year that we've had some, with a lot of other people, I guess, some financial issues that we've had to address that haven't been very pleasant. And, of course, affecting mostly staff. But then when you start making changes like that, that is also something that it's hard for people to deal with sometimes, depending on what their particular focus is.
Do people pitch in and do things that otherwise might be paying jobs, like maybe building maintenance?
Yeah, we do have a part-time, we do pay for a part-time custodial, but we have at least as much stuff done by volunteers as the custodial person, so setting up tables and chairs and that kind of thing. I think it's something that I've feel like it's probably pretty common in most churches or any church that I've been involved in where people do that. And, you know, whether it's preparing meals for people that need it for health reasons or funerals or whatever, we happen to have that going on in a major way right now with losing some people through death, but so those kinds of things, and we have lay people who are involved with maintaining and overseeing kind of the building maintenance and property and grounds. So there's a lot of that kind of thing. So I guess secretarial or office administration help, part-time, like half-time custodial. And for a long period of time, we had, as long as I knew anything about the church, as long as I've been involved with the church, we had a half-time music director. And we were real fortunate to have a very good organist, two different people that did that, held that position in the 20 years or so that I've been there, and two very fine musicians that we hired to fill that position. And we also had, until recently, a real part-time, I think it was paid maybe 10 hours a month, or 10 hours a week, youth director. So that would be mainly for high school and junior high age students as opposed to campus or university. Excuse me.
You mentioned financial problems, which I think an awful lot of, you know, any kind of voluntary organization, mm-hmm. when times are a little bit tough, they're the ones that hurt first.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to ask how it's structured. Do you have an annual pledge drive or
something like that?
We do. We have what we call a stewardship drive. Usually have some kind of organized effort to get people to make commitments of how much they're, and to express either, usually confidentially, how much you're promising to give to the church, to the general operating fund, or any other gift you want to make, and so that you can get kind of a handle on budget for the coming year, because we're just dependent on what continues to be coming in through our general offices. And so we don't have a pool of money to use for the next year and then build that up and start over again. It's what's coming in as we operate. So those kinds of things fluctuate. But we've really, I think, for the church our size, we've been maintaining pretty well. I think we probably were a little overextended in terms of what we had going as far as staff was concerned at one point, and we kind of had to back off of that a little bit. The main thing was that the Kansas district had been supporting the largest share of our campus pastor's position, salary-wise, and district monies have gone down even in a more serious way, probably than a lot of individual congregations. Certainly ours. I don't think ours has gone down anywhere near what our reduction has been. Mainly there, it's been that kind of thing. So it's a. It was an interesting kind of unusual relationship that goes back to that independent campus church, university church, which was fully funded, fully funded by the district, which means contributions from churches throughout the Lutheran churches throughout the state of Kansas, and then distributed by the district office. We also had, at the same time, however, we had a very successful capital campaign for our new building. I mean, we raised almost $800,000 for going for that. It ended up being about, of course, more expensive than you think it's going to be, but it ended up being $1.2 million plus, I think. And so our mortgage on that is going to be manageable. We're still kind of in a transition phase between building and actual mortgage going into effect, so we're still raising money for that. But that was a very successful campaign, and we were really blessed to have, for the most part, a real high percentage of people follow through on the commitments that they've made on that. So the timing for the economic downturn could probably not have been worse in a lot of ways, but if you look at it and you step back a little bit and think, well, you know, under the circumstances, things aren't so bad. Things don't seem that bad. We've had to make some tough decisions, but I think that's been happening all across the economy. I know it certainly has happened in state government where I'm at.
Yes, don't we know?
How have you noticed, if at all, how does the church, are you volunteering to preserve the church's history, or how does the church preserve its history?
That's a good question. I'm technically, I actually served as president of the congregation a couple years ago, and we have a kind of a system where it's actually a 3-year commitment, because you go in as vice president, then you're president, and then you're past president, and you have duties along the way. And so I finished mine a little over a year ago, my 3-year stint. And after that, after I was approaching the end of that, I agreed to be appointed church historian. I thought, well, this makes sense, probably. And it also, I can say, well, now I am church historian, remember, don't ask me to do something. But I haven't done as much as I had planned to do, but it's been real hit and miss. I think just like with all organizations, I mean, any kind of, whether religious or otherwise, Some organizations do a good job of preserving their history. I think we do, you know, we have an archive. We preserve kind of what we pass for an archive. I mean, we keep records of different kinds. We do have some materials that go back pretty early in the church's history. We have started, or we're starting and kind of got to a point where we put it on hold, an oral history project, which we really hasn't got launched yet, but we've started talking a little bit about that and doing a little bit towards that, and want to pursue that so that, you know, do different things like that. And, of course, at different times, like most churches, people will get together and they'll put out I think our most recent one was a 75th anniversary history booklet. For what that's worth, it can be helpful.
I can tell you those are very useful at the end of the dispenser. Centennials or
right.
Whatever.
And I think that that can be those can be really good. And say pictures and various things of that nature. So we think about that. And several of us are conscious of it, and it's just a matter of keeping at it and making sure that. Some things are preserved. So, documenting this and that.
Do you know any other members who are eager to be interviewed then? For all this elder? Well, we want to get the voices of, you know.
Yeah.
Not youthful members such as yourself, but
people right.
Who've been around.
Yeah, you're just a young guy.
Rather than speaking. Well, I think I could pass along some names if you're interested in other people from Emmanuel.
Be interested in some names. I don't know how many more opportunities we have this semester, but I would like to have a backlog of names.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Well, we're going to quit here, I think, before long. Well, let me ask you if you have anything else you want to say about your own experience or about Emmanuel Lutheran, and then I have something else I want to ask you separately.
Well, my experience, I've had various, as I mentioned earlier, various kinds of experiences with a few different churches, but I think there's always the things you could dwell on and be negative about, but overall I think it's been a very positive thing for me, certainly. My relationship with the people and the church there at Emmanuel. So I would end on that positive, my part on a positive note, that even though you can talk about all these problems and issues that come up and the divisiveness, I think it's something that you just deal with and realize is a part of human nature and life, and go on and do the best you can. It's there's a lot of good folks in the church that work hard and I think make a difference in the community as well as in the church body.
Okay, well, that's a good positive note. All right, sure. Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you, and this is a completely different thing really, but some of the students here are doing projects that are not only involving interviews but also standard research, mm-hmm. documentary research and things. And I just wonder, this is a huge thing in a way, but can you characterize at all what kinds of resources are at the State Historical Society? You guys have a lot of stuff, I happen to know.
Yeah, well, you probably know as much about it as I do. I mean, in terms of...
I know about my little
somebody
narrow...
Somebody who's worked on that.
Bit of it.
But we really do have a lot of material from a lot of stuff having to do with missions in Indian missions, American Indian missions. We have diaries and journals and so forth, and letters and correspondence from the people that came out with various tribes or to serve various Indian tribes during the 1830s and 40s, on up through the territorial period and well beyond, whether they're church publications or some of those church histories that you mentioned, and a few collections, well, in addition to the Sheldon stuff, which is very rich. There are a few others. I'm not sure there's any that are the size of Sheldon's, materials, but there are some other ministers from the 19th century that we do have some material on. And
do you have local church histories?
Yeah, we would have some of that. I'm not sure how much, but yeah, we have quite a bit. Probably the biggest. I would guess it's probably as maybe the single biggest collection, certainly in Kansas, of that kind of material. And we get a lot of things. We have lots of local histories, which I'm more familiar with, just regular local histories from almost every county.
And which I think would almost always include some religious.
Which does also, also includes things about the churches. I was just looking at, in fact, at a couple today or yesterday of the, like, lots of things were produced either during the, for some of us in the eastern part of the state during the centennial, and then you had the sesquicentennial of in 1876 and 1976, the sesquicentennial of the nation's independence, and then 200th anniversary, bicentennial.
Bicentennial.
I'm stuck on sesquicentennial 150 because that's Kansas.
That's where we are.
That's all I know. Yeah. That's all I know anymore. So the bicentennial in 1976, and then again in 1987. So you get a lot of there's a lot of those local histories that come out of that 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And so, and they do, you're right, have a lot of stuff on churches, early and current churches. So, and church newspapers, publications of various kinds that we would have.
That's your guy, Tennessee Town, right? Shelby.
Yeah.
With the materials there, I haven't used them myself a lot, but
I haven't in many years.
Yeah,
there's quite a collection.
A lot of stuff, and sermons and things that he manuscripts of things that he published, and that's the kind of things I know we have. A few of those that are very interesting for some of the early, like, territorial ministers who came out, and there are lots of those people who had involvement with the church as well as being involved politically with that territorial conflict, free state, pro-slavery conflict. So you have a few of those kinds of individuals. I'm not sure. I'm trying to. And then, of course, I don't know what else we have. I did bring a copy of the review essay that Gary Entz, who at that time was professor of history at McPherson, on religion in Kansas, that we published in, this one was in 2005, that would give a few clues of what kind of sources are available, which is good for focusing attention on some topics that maybe are in real need of research, as well as kind of giving a general history of religion in Kansas, and then also you can use them very effectively to kind of focus in on sources that might be available.
I was going to ask, in relation to your magazine, are there opportunities for students to publish work through the magazine?
If it's good enough. we have, anybody can submit, and we have on a few fairly rare occasions published undergraduate or someone who was maybe a senior thesis. Usually, if it's a student, it's a graduate student, simply because of the kind of research that people have done by that time. And so, but we've published a number of articles by master's students or people who just finished their master's and certainly PhDs. But it's, and I've got one now that we're dealing with, and I've sent it, and we use a peer review process. This one has to do with labor unrest, mining issue, but it's, and so it's not religion, but this was done by a kid in who was just starting his undergraduate work, and so it came out of some secondary research that he did as a secondary student. And he then worked on it to find it. Of course, his mother's a historian. And not that I think she did it, it's just that he's gotten some good advice along the way, and there's some real direction that's been going on. And it's pretty impressive. I mean, it'll be published before too long, I think. So that may be a record. Somebody who's just beginning his undergraduate work will have a publication probably within a year or so. I mean, it was something that people were really positive about. Three different readers, and all seniors, all scholars who have been around for quite a while, except one's a younger scholar, two senior scholars, and both very impressed, all three very impressed. Some good ideas for revision, but nothing that's certainly insurmountable. And I've had contact with him, and he's real enthused about following through. So that's a rarity. That will be a first. Like I said, I've had two, I think, that came out of senior theses. I've had some others that have been submitted by people who were finishing their undergraduate degrees when they wrote their work, and they've had a lot of potential, but a lot of times students at that point in their career are then going off and doing something else, and they don't get back to the revision that's needed. So there's certainly the opportunity there, and we're interested in looking at anything.
Yeah, blind peer review can be surprising, I know, because I've been involved in it long enough, and it is blind. You don't know whose work you're reading, which I think makes it really fair. And if you have someone who is not a senior scholar but has really good ideas and can write well and clearly communicate well and all, you can publish anywhere, mm-hmm. basically. That's the way it works.
Yeah. It's fair, and it makes it interesting and real democratic.
It is democratic. And Kansas history is a good place. I know from my own experience they're helpful and will support your work if they think it's good stuff, but it needs further work. They'll tell you and support the work and help you find illustrations and things. It's nicely done. So, people in here could come up with things, I have no doubt.
I think that religion in Kansas is a topic that, it's probably surprising. It surprises me when you think about it, that there's been, some things done, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly because historians maybe are a little reluctant to deal with that as a topic. So you focus on other things that are important and have an impact on people's lives, but with something as important as religion, over the years, and you think about, as you all do, how important that is to people, and yet we look at, political persuasion, we look at jobs, we look at all these other things in a person's lives that causes them to do what they do, but we haven't, I think, as historians, been real good at figuring out how to deal with religion.
Well, it's a little bit of a third rail.
It is.
People
are
a little scared of it.
And so I think as a result, you end up with a historiography that's deficient in an area that really should be rich in that. So, but I'll leave this, if you
sure.
want, I'll leave this and take a look at this article. I don't need it back. I thought
it was,
this one is, yeah. And I thought, for example, he says, in one point, he says, religiously, Kansas is a microcosm of America. If you know Kansas and literature about Kansas history, that term has been, the microcosm analogy has been used in a lot of different ways about Kansas. But I think that's an interesting way of looking at religion in Kansas, too. Because, for example, he says, I was looking at what he said about Lutherans before I came in.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, Nebraska is about where, it's the northern plains, really, that's the area of this part of the country that's been mostly affected by Lutherans. You get further south and it's Southern Baptist. Kansas is kind of in the middle, and there's southern and northern and eastern influences mm-hmm. that come here. We always think of Methodism as being very important, and it is, but there's a pretty diverse religious experience in the state from very early on. So.
And Methodism itself is kind of middle of the road, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is. But I'll leave this and take a look. We do have quite a few articles that are online on our website. Our website has just been relaunched, I guess, redesigned and relaunched, and I'm not quite sure how that's affecting. I'm a little bit behind on that. But I think it's still pretty easy to find the publication page and find the articles that are online, and the review essays are all there. We did a series of those 20-some review essays on different topics in Kansas history, kind of not just historiographical, but partly historiographical, partly speculating or suggesting what kind of work needs to be picked up and completed.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming in. Just to cap it off for the record here, this has been Virgil Dean, interviewed on his life experience and his experience at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Lawrence. It is November 9th, 2010. We're in Smith Hall at KU. And thank you very much, Virgil, for coming in. Thank you.